You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Stephen Forrester. He's a historian and author whose work focuses on the political and social history of the American West, particularly Oregon's transformation during the 20th century. His research explores how regional leaders, public policy debates, and grassroots movements shaped the modern political landscape of the Pacific Northwest. Stephen is the author of Richard Neuberger, Oregon Politics and the Making of a U.S. Senator. It's a deeply researched biography that brings renewed attention to one of Oregon's most influential mid-century political leaders, whose legacy helped shape the state's environmental leadership and evolving political identity. Welcome to The Exchange, Stephen.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, let's start with a bit of your background. Where'd you grow up?
Pendleton.
And what led you toward an interest in writing about politics?
Well, my father was a newspaper editor, which I eventually became. And so I was around politics my whole life. Politics and politicians.
So what first drew your attention to Richard Neuberger as a historical subject?
Well, the Neubergers were guests in our home in Pendleton. My father and he were student editors of the Oregon State Paper and the Oregon Daily Emerald at the University of Oregon. So they got to know each other that way. And so they were old friends, and they would come to our house. Dick and Maureen Neuberger would come to our house in Pendleton. And so on his last visit to our home, I was 13, which I think is, you know, when you're 13, you begin to pay attention more. And he sat across from me at lunch and proceeded to tell a story about the Falcon that he had seen at Multnomah Stadium the day prior at halftime at a football game with the Air Force Academy. And he was totally entrancing. He went home after seeing that Falcon and read everything he could read about Falcons and proceeded to tell us about it. So in my mind, he was the ultimate classroom teacher.
So you became enamored with him.
I'm fascinated is the word, I think. I don't know if I was enamored with him, but I was certainly fascinated with this amazing personality. And then he dies not long thereafter. And so I came to my decision to do a biography many years later when I was in my 30s.
Well, can you read a passage from your book?
Sure. This is about Dick Neuberger's decision to run for the U.S. Senate in 1954, which is the pivotal moment in his life, if you will. Neuberger made his decision to run for the United States Senate in 1954 for more than one reason. To him and his allies, including Monroe Sweetland and Chairman Howard, Oregon's Democratic Party registration was significant bait. The number of Democrats in Oregon had increased markedly during the post-war years, and the party wanted to prove that a liberal Democrat could gain traction with the electorate. As a writer whose name was familiar to many Oregonians and a strikingly new kind of Democratic legislator, Neuberger was well cast for the role. Just as important to Dick was something more personal and painful, the pain that he felt as a spurned activist and Jewish outsider at the University of Oregon. Dick came away from the university wanting to prove something to those people who had opposed him, Lloyd Tupling later explained. He wanted to rub their noses in it.
How would you summarize Richard Neuberger to someone who never heard of him?
He was a writer and politician. He was an enormously prolific writer and consequential politician in Oregon's and the United States history. And he was also a phenomenal, prodigious writer, writing some 350 or 750, depending on the number you want to agree with, articles in his lifetime. Six books, two of which he co-authored.
So what were the most significant sources that shaped your understanding of Neuberger?
They're at the University of Oregon in the special collections. That's where his papers are. And also, that was a main source, but also I interviewed a bevy of people, starting with his mother, his sister, his widow, his nieces, and brother-in-law, and so forth. So it gave me, I wanted not simply to do the biography of his life, I wanted to get at the inner person. which those people helped me do.
Well, during your research, did you discover anything about Neuberger that surprised you or challenged the prevailing historical narrative?
Yes, many things. He's very insecure, was one thing that surprised me. He never graduated from the University of Oregon. He's one of those guys. But his time at the university was it was not a conventional student experience he had. He was the student editor of the Emerald. He was a as we would call him, a rabble rouser, a social activist. And that was not appreciated, especially by the fraternity crowd. And he was Jewish. He was an outsider at the university. So that's kind of the nub of it.
Well, how did Neuberger's upbringing and his early experiences shape his political worldview?
Well, in many ways, the Neuberger family was a very tight family in Portland, in Willamette Heights in Portland. And it was a three-generation household. His grandma was very attached to his grandmother. His grandmother had breast cancer. And she died in the house, which you would imagine dying in the house of breast cancer in that era of 1912 or 13 was devastating to Neuberger. And that developed in the eyes of many of his contemporaries, a lifelong hypochondria and a special fear of cancer, which is eventually how he died.
How did his work in journalism that you mentioned influence his later policy priorities and his governing philosophy?
Well, his topics mainly were the same topics he enunciated in the Oregon legislature, which were welfare, representation, equal representation, because that was in the period when the one man, one vote decision had not been rendered yet. And so rural Oregon had an outsized representation in the state legislature, where his district in Multnomah County was underrepresented. That all changed later. He was also very conscious of the status of minorities in the state. And in 1933, he made an epical journey to Nazi Germany with his uncle Julius, who was fluent in German and was his translator. And during that visit, they learned exactly what Hitler's brown shirts were up to way before the rest of America knew. Came back, wrote an article about that, published in The Nation magazine, and it became a national factor. It put him on the national stage at a very early age, 21.
My guest is Stephen Forrester, author of Richard Neuberger, Oregon Politics and the Making of a U.S. Senator. So you're telling me that in 1933, he visited Nazi Germany?
Yes. Yeah, it was a very bold move. He had been a student editor at the University of Oregon of the Emerald, and the Emerald, under his leadership, was a remarkable piece of work, not only covering college politics, but the rest of the state, and also sometimes international affairs, such as Hitler's rise in Germany. So you will find in the Emerald in 1933, I've forgotten what date it was, around January, I suppose, whenever it was that Hitler took power. And so Neuberger puts Hitler's face on the front page of the Emerald.
So that was about the time of the rise of the America First movement, the Christian mm-hmm. Front. Charles Lindbergh was giving speeches praising Nazi Germany. And the German-American Bund was prolific across the nation, with many members. It became mainstream to be part of that movement with America First and the German-American Bund. How did this man, Neuberger, Richard Neuberger, how did he rise among that kind of sentiment in the country.
Through his writing, the article he wrote when he came back from Germany, it was called The New Germany. That was a play on Joseph Goebbels' advertising slogan for Germany. But I hasten to add, Mike, that the most curious contradiction about Neuberger is that in 1938, there was a nationwide student strike at colleges about the war, whether to end the war or not. And Reed College in Portland used the day for education. And so one of the events they had was a debate on the lawn of Reed, a broad lawn that's right in front of Reed College, featuring Dick Neuberger and a young man named Oscar Gass, who was a Reed College graduate and a Rhodes Scholar. And it was whether to enter the war. And like so many other men of his age, young men of his age, including John Kennedy, Neuberger took the staying out of war side. And Gass took the other side to enter the war. It was surprising because in his piece, which you can see in my book, The New Germany, he says, you know, essentially, we're going to war. We know this. He writes that in 1933.
So what distinguished Neuberger's campaign strategy from other candidates in his era?
He was very personal. It was one of the most personal campaigns ever waged in Oregon. The way it was described in Time magazine and other national and state periodicals was Dick and Maureen drove from town to town, and I mean small town to small town, not just the cities, and where Dick would speak. And it was essentially a one-man operation and woman operation. That was it. He also put 85% of his campaign budget on radio. And those radio commercials are fascinating to listen to. I have them all. They've been digitized. And then also the other thing that was a first in that campaign was that Neuberger was competitive in fundraising. He raised, the money sounds quaint today, but he raised something like $138,000, I think it was. And his opponent, Guy Corden of Roseburg, was slightly ahead of that.
So at that time, the most prolific voice on the radio was the voice of Father Coughlin, who was a white supremacist, a white nationalist.
Right.
And he praised Hitler and the Nazis. And you're saying that Dick Neuberger also used the radio for his campaign.
For the state campaign, yes. I'm sorry, the United States Senate campaign. Precisely. Yeah. And his campaign manager was a former, he had been the manager of a radio stations in Bend and in La Grande. And his manager was very adept at buying up time. So they essentially bought up all the time they could buy so that once his opponent came back to Oregon to run, most of the prime time spots were gone.
So we have about a minute left. What coalitions or demographic groups were most critical to Neuberger's electoral success?
Well, oddly enough, it was rural Oregon that he won big time. And Oregon then was far more of a farming state than it is now. And I detail this in my book. The number of farms and the acreage in farms was much higher then than it is now. And so Neuberger aimed a lot of his radio commercials and otherwise campaigning at rural Oregon. And the other thing that the other factor was that Republicans did not vote in the numbers that had been expected. That helped him a lot.
So he ran as a Democrat?
Yes, he did. He was the first Democrat elected to the U.S. Senate from Oregon in 40 years. He turned the state blue in that election.
Okay, on that note, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Stephen Forrester, author of Richard Neuberger, Oregon Politics and the Making of a U.S. Senator. Now, before the break, you were telling me that Richard Neuberger was the first Democrat elected in that era from Oregon. Is that right?
Yes, to the U.S. Senate. Yeah, he'd been in the legislature already, but this was to the U.S. Senate. And so he was the first Democrat elected to the Senate from Oregon in 40 years. He was also the second Jew elected to the U.S. Senate, nationwide, obviously. The first Jew was Herbert Lehman of New York, which in a sense is understandable. But then for the second Jew to be elected from Oregon was far more surprising and was commented on nationally.
3,000 miles away from New York. What role did his wife Maureen play in his campaign?
An enormous role. Afterward, he was fond of narrating his own life in his articles. And he wrote an article that was titled, "My Wife Put Me in the U.S. Senate." He was given some overstatement, but not in that case. She really was a major factor. And in two ways. One, she was his companion on the campaign trail. But also, when they went to rural communities, she was identified immediately by farm women as one of them. She had grown up in Cloverdale, which is on the coast of Oregon, dairy farmhouse family, I should say. Maureen, in general, had the ability to talk to anyone, and people grasped that very quickly. My mother explained to me once that they had gone with the Neubergers out to the little town of Weston in eastern Oregon, outside Pendleton, for a farm dinner, campaign dinner. And before the event started, Dick would talk to a few people near the podium and all that. But Maureen would be surrounded by other women who had identified her as one of them.
So what was their message?
Well, it was more than one message. The biggest message was he criticized his opponent for what he called the giveaways. These were essentially economic giveaways by the Republican Party, by Eisenhower's Secretary of the Interior, Douglas McKay, a former governor of Oregon. And Guy Cordon, his opponent, had gone along with all of those, essentially cost the country money.
So in what ways did Neuberger's campaign signal a broader political shift that was taking place in Oregon during the mid-20th century?
It marshaled all those Democrats who'd moved to Oregon, for one thing. He gave them a candidate to vote for, so that was very important. He was a national figure by then. He'd written so much in so many national publications that he was well-known across the country. And of course, one of his staple issues was conservation. In these days, it would be called environmentalism, but that had not entered the lexicon yet. That's a lot of what he wrote about and was known for nationally. So you find in the papers at the University of Oregon, files on the response of voters after the election. And what you see there is letters from common folks across the country saying, "I was hanging on the vote in Oregon because it took 2 days to count this vote. He won by 2,642 votes, less than one vote per precinct across Oregon." And they said, "We feel so glad that you are entering the Senate will be a voice for conservation."
Well, it's interesting because conservation, as you said, was not a top priority for voters. What would you identify as the most important policy areas, let's say the three most important policy areas that define Neuberger's Senate career?
Well, the most important one to Oregon was the termination of the Klamath Indian tribe. That was set in motion by the Eisenhower administration. That was their policy, to terminate Indian tribes. Well, the Klamath tribe sat on the largest stand of ponderosa pine in North America, and also very significant marshlands. And so what Neuberger did, his peers made him the chairman of the Indian Affairs Subcommittee of the Interior Committee. And so he used that power to slow down the process of termination, give him time to work out the timber matter. And so, and also at that point, there had not been hearings out here. And so he held hearings in Klamath County and in Portland, and one for the timber industry itself. Essentially, what he was able to do was cut a deal with a new Interior Secretary, Fred Seaton, who succeeded McKay of Oregon. That deal allowed all but 10% of the Klamath's timberland to be transferred to the federal government, and it became the Wainema National Forest. The other 10% could be sold to private interests, but had to be managed in a sustained yield fashion. So that was the main thing he was known for in Oregon at the time, and it led to his popularity. He was also an original co-sponsor of the National Wilderness Act. He managed to pass the Highway Beautification Act, whose legislative history I detail in the book.
Okay, so he was known for conservation. He was known for the National Wilderness Act. And he's known for as a popular figure among the timber industry?
Not the timber industry, no, necessarily, but in Klamath County and elsewhere, for getting something done for Oregon. That was what he was known for.
Okay. My guest is Stephen Forrester, author of Richard Neuberger, Oregon Politics and the Making of a U.S. Senator. Let's back up just for a second, because when you talked about the termination of the Klamath Indian tribe and Neuberger's role in slowing that process, why did he slow the process? What was the point of that?
He needed time to negotiate a solution for the timber matter. He happily, as I've already said, got a new partner in Fred Seaton, the Secretary of the Interior, but also in the way that, you know, often such things are worked out with the underlings within the department of the Forest Service and otherwise, because those people have to go along with it and so forth. And also at a key moment, he was able to get the support of George Weyerhaeuser of the timber industry, of course. And that was important because the industry leaders were not speaking out on this issue at all. And Weyerhaeuser did, and that helped turn the tide for Neuberger.
Well, how is he remembered today among the Klamath Indians?
I don't know that he is. He's a forgotten figure statewide. I don't know how many people, and you included, I think, read my book, and every page was, "I didn't know that." He was terribly consequential, remains consequential in the historical record, but he's largely unknown.
It's true. I learned so much that I didn't know. Neuberg is remembered for his environmental leadership, though. Would you say
yes,
he was a pioneer in his conservation efforts?
Oh, he was. I, through a go-between, I was able to get comment from Justice William O. Douglas, who was obviously still in the Supreme Court when I got in touch with him. And in answer to one of my questions, he said he was absolutely a conservationist ahead of his time.
So how did Neuberger influence the political perspectives and policies of Oregon governors and other elected Oregon officials?
Well, I interviewed Mark Hatfield when he was U.S. Senator about that, because Hatfield was governor of Oregon when Neuberger was elected. And essentially what Hatfield said, and it's in the book, of course, is that it forced the Republicans in Oregon to become more to the center, to be competitive in that way. And so you have Hatfield, for instance, becoming essentially what was then called a liberal Republican, you know, an extinct species now.
What were Neuberger's views in any legislative actions regarding civil rights and other democratic reforms?
Well, he favored, there was a Civil Rights Act in Oregon, which he and Hatfield collaborated on. And it was essentially an accommodations act, a public accommodations act. He was, as I say, a co-sponsor. And then when he got to Washington, D.C., Lyndon Johnson of Texas, then who became majority leader upon Neuberger's election, put forward a Civil Rights Act of 1957. And Neuberger favored that. He voted for it. He was not around for the Civil Rights Act of 64. That was, Maureen was. She voted for it.
So he died in 1960?
Yes, March of 1960. March 8th, actually.
Do you know what caused that?
Well, it was testicular cancer was the original culprit, shall we say. But it eventually spread to his lungs and to his brain. And I interviewed Dick's physician, and that's in the book. And you'll see what he said there.
What did his wife do after his passing?
Well, he had anointed her as his successor before his death. And so the party had to come up with the candidate, and that was Maureen. On the one hand, she was well-suited for that role, you might say. But on the other hand, as her top aide said, it was a hell of a role for her to hoe because she was recently widowed. She's mourning, and she's got to go out and run for office, which she did and won very handily.
In your assessment, what was the most enduring aspect of Neuberger's legacy in Oregon?
Oh, I think the liberal Oregon Democratic Party, which still exists, and Oregon's at least spoken advocacy of environmentalism. Tom McCall said that Neuberger was his role model. And you can see in what McCall did, you know, the bottle bill and the law establishing the public use of the beaches and other things. You see Neuberger in that.
Nationally, where do you think historians should place Neuberger among mid-century reformers?
Well, fairly high up. Justice Douglas made this point, and Lloyd Tupling, his top aide, made the same point. Neuberger always regarded himself as planting seeds for something that would happen long after he was gone. And I think that's the case. My original working title for the book was Ahead of His Time, which was changed by my publisher, which is fine. But that's what he was. He was ahead of his time.
Well, what lessons? I'm sorry, go ahead.
He essentially predicted where things were going to go in his writing and otherwise. And in the causes he supported in the Oregon legislature and in Congress.
Were there any policy initiatives that he championed that were controversial or politically risky at that time?
Yes. I mean, something as plain vanilla as highway beautification was controversial. And in Oregon, you have to realize that by the time he was elected, the Republican Party's hegemony over Oregon had lasted a half century into the late 19th century. So in a way, every time he opened his mouth, he was both controversial, but also formidable. He's very quick-witted and someone to be reckoned with on the legislative floor.
So we have about 30 seconds left. What do you hope readers most clearly understand about Richard Neuberger that they may not have known before?
Not a flippant answer here, but I'd say everything. It's like your experience and so many others that I know now who have read the book who said, you know, I didn't know that. Brent Wolff, in his review of my book, said, you know, it essentially fills in a missing link. Because we know about Hatfield and we know about Tom McCall, but Neuberger was right between them, so to speak, and we don't know that story at all.
So very quickly, are there any lessons that contemporary political leaders can learn from Neuberger's approach to journalism, campaigning, and policymaking?
Oh, yes. and which is to say, be articulate and craft your arguments well. And speak out and speak publicly. That's a message that could be, you know, given to many in both parties, really. In my years as an editor, I often occasionally would write an article saying that, or an editorial saying that what the Republicans in this state needed was a Dick Neuberger, someone who wouldn't just, you know, obey the party line, which is what so many of them have done, and speak out and speak loudly. But Democrats as well.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. That's all the time we have. Thank you, Stephen, for writing this book.
Yeah, you're welcome, Mike. Thanks for having me on your show.
My guest was Stephen Forrester, author of Richard Neuberger, Oregon Politics and the Making of a U.S. Senator. I'm Mike Green.